Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Thank you and good evening, everybody, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. So again, I'm Amina Jindali, founding member and director of content for the Islamic Networks Group and your chair for today's program. We also welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. So as you all know, today's topic is Park 51, New York City Islamic Community Center Project. And while the topic is no longer as hot as it was over the summer and into the fall, it's probably a topic that will be revisited again and is tied to the larger issue of American Muslims' place in this country and the growing issue of Islamophobia. So here to help us better understand this issue, it is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Munir Jiwa. Dr. Munir Jiwa is the founding director for the Center for Islamic Studies and is an assistant professor of Islamic Studies at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. He holds a PhD and Master's of Philosophy in Anthropology from Columbia University and an MTS in World Religions from Harvard Divinity School. His research interests include Islam and Muslims in the West, media, aesthetics, religious pluralism and identity. And since 1995, he has worked with Religion for Peace on interfaith programs in Bosnia, Japan, the Middle East, and West Africa. He has also worked with the Ford Foundation-funded Muslims in New York Project, New York City Project, at Columbia University from 1998 to 2004. His book manuscript is currently being reviewed for publication and is tentatively entitled Exhibiting Islam, Art, Politics, and Identity in New York City. His presentation will last from 30 to 40 minutes. As he speaks, we hope that you will come up with questions. We will have note cards distributed for the questions, and then we will take about 20 to 30 minutes to address those questions. So I now want to welcome Dr. Munir Jiwa.
Thank you, Amina, for that warm welcome. Assalamu alaikum and greetings of peace to you all. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club and especially Celia Menschel, who always keeps us abreast of the wonderful programs here, and for this very kind invitation. So I'm very happy to be here with you all and to thank you for taking the time to come listen. I'd be curious to sort of hear where we're at with this topic, given its newsworthiness at one point and then not so newsworthiness at another. And so that is, in fact, one of the questions I sort of want to begin with and maybe frame it. What I plan to do is just talk a little bit about the project itself, the Park 51 project, and then putting it in the context of a larger sort of politics in America that we're seeing today, followed by some ethical considerations that we might think about. And there's a PowerPoint that I have, which we may get through a few slides of, and then open it up for discussion. And again, we welcome the questions and discussion at the end. So as you're probably aware, the Park 51 project, and I call it project and projection at the same time. I gave a presentation recently at UC Berkeley, and I was talking about how, in some ways, even before the project has come into being, we've already sort of projected onto it certain imagining. So it's a relationship between what we imagine this center to be and the reality on the ground. And again, there's a sense that facts on the ground don't necessarily meet up with the emotional projections we might have on it, or the very real concerns that people have. At the outset, I should say that even though I'm couching this in a larger context of America and the heightened Islamophobia that we're seeing, I also want to remind us that there's no sort of unanimous voice or opinion on the park. There's a whole diverse sort of set of opinions that Muslims and non-Muslims alike have about the project itself. What interests me is the ways in which those various interests and those diverse interests have been mobilized for different political ends, as well as those that are around questions of legitimacy. And so just to begin, I want to put this into kind of a socio-political context, as well as then to move to thinking about what does this say in terms of the nature of religion and Islam itself in America. So as I mentioned, there's a whole range, even amongst Muslims, of whether the project should exist or not, and what form it should exist, what would be the predominant quote-unquote denomination that runs this. Is Imam Faisal, who was Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, that most of you probably have heard his name now, is he a good Muslim or a bad Muslim? And we often identify him in ways that are, well, he must be a good Muslim because the State Department has put him on tour, or he must be a good Muslim because he's got Sufi leanings. But you know, there's those kinds of concerns that people have of you know, theological commitments, to ones that are just basic concerns about, you know, funding, to what will a mosque look like in the context of other sorts of, I think, the kinds of projects that they're envisioning, you know, culinary school, recreational facilities, and the like, that kind of create this as a community center. Two things that have really couched the initial response to project. One was the questions around sensitivity. You know, by building this, are Muslims and those who are proponents of this project being insensitive to the feelings of those who have lost loved ones on 9/11, or those who managed to experience the events of 9/11. So this is a question of sensitivity. The other is a question of proximity. You know, how close the proposed project is to 9/11. And these have been sort of the rallying areas through which a lot of claims have been made for people who are for or against the project. The question that I began with, which is, why is it that at certain historical moments this was a non-issue? This project, as we know, has been several years in the making. People have been praying in this, what used to be a Burlington coat factory, for months now, so at least since December 2009. And it was not really newsworthy until much later, we'd say in spring and into summer of 2010, where this took on a different kind of meaning. So the very process by which something becomes newsworthy is interesting, and we also need to question that very process. How is it that something that was quote-unquote a sort of marginal issue, maybe some would argue a non-issue, to becoming central by the summer, and then central to the midterm elections as well? So it's a question I'm putting out there. What is the very process by which the Park 51 project comes into to being? And then to ask the related question of, so at what points does the project no longer interest us? And maybe to ask ourselves the questions as we're kind of going through the presentations of what we remember about the project. You know, what is it that we initially thought about it? What did we actually learn when there was a kind of heightened discussion around the project as it was tied to sort of the midterm elections? And now what we actually remember about it, and what has happened in our own thinking process about this. But one of the ways in which the project became an issue was when it went from just being Cordoba House, or then later Park 51 Islamic Community Center, to the Ground Zero Mosque. And I know this is not being videotaped, but recorded, so this is quotes. I'm doing the quote sign. The Ground Zero Mosque, or the Mega Mosque, or the Victory Mosque. And all of these sort of adjectives and ways in which to describe the project were used pejoratively. they were not used to heighten the sense of, wow, how beautiful that we're going to have this 13-story mosque / community center right near Ground Zero. It was used to really show how this mega mosque was in fact sort of being built right near Ground Zero, and it was being juxtaposed with the term Ground Zero. So the word mosque somehow is used in a way to show that it's somewhat, and we can debate this, polluting the sanctity or the sacredness of Ground Zero. You know, so by putting these things together, it's showing that the mosque actually defines Ground Zero or pollutes it somehow. So this whole idea of it being too close, the proximity question of the mosque being too close to Ground Zero, is that somehow, fundamentally, this mosque does not belong there because it's doing something to the sanctity of Ground Zero. Now, we can also say that it's not at Ground Zero and it's not a mosque, but the question I want to ask is, it's, well, what if it is a mosque alone, and what if it is right at Ground Zero? Michael Moore did this spoof that he doesn't want a mosque, and you can see it on Huffington Post and on his website. He doesn't want a mosque near Ground Zero. He wants it on Ground Zero, you know. And it's, the interesting thing about that is that there were already prayer spaces in the World Trade Center, you know, what we might call a prayer room or what we might call a masjid or a mosque or a prayer space. So that was already the WTC's actual site. So he's not so far off in his claim. But what's interesting is this whole idea of proximity and somehow keeping the sacred space of Ground Zero pure and clean from this mosque. So the question I ask, well, what if it is a mosque and what if it's at Ground Zero? Now think of the other question about sensitivity. Many Muslims who had been part of the project and interested in the project had gone from an initial proposal of it being a mosque, maybe not quite a dome and minaret kind of mosque, which is not necessary for a mosque, but often features that you will see. They're not architecturally or theologically necessary in Islam, but you know, mosques are often identified by their domes and minarets. Now, one might try to imagine, well, what if it was a dome and minaret kind of mosque? Would the outcry have been different? The fact that it's a community center and bringing so much anxiety, and what does this really say about freedom of religion? So the question about the community center is one also of the constant negotiation that Muslims have already made, including the Asma Society and Imam Faisal, about taking seriously the considerations and the suggestions that were made to the Muslim community by various members. They said, well, why don't you model it on the YMCA or the JCC? And that was already in their thinking initially a few years ago. That was already the dream that Imam Faisal and Daisy had had, to not just have a mosque, but to have a larger space. Well, it takes a lot of compromise and it takes a lot of negotiation to say, well, we're not just going to have a prayer space now, but we're going to have a culinary school, we're going to have a recreation center, it's going to have an interfaith space. But what makes this exceptional, I think, is that we would never demand necessarily other communities to fit this, what I would call a liberal acceptance of Islam or Muslims. You know, the only ways in which Muslims and Islam can be accepted or their centers to be accepted is that if it wasn't just a prayer space but open to everyone. A really good rabbi friend of mine has said that I should use this, and she's used this many times as a way of looking at how exceptional this case is when it comes to Muslims. She claims that we would never do this, for example, to an Orthodox synagogue, to ask them to have men's and women's prayer spaces together, asking them to have a culinary school, asking them to have, you know, because when we talk about freedom of religion, we're talking about people's right to their prayer spaces. And in the ways in which they might imagine it. So already the Park 51 team has taken a lot into consideration in terms of moving from just a prayer space into a space where it's going to be memorializing those who lost their lives and their families on 9/11. It's going to, again, have the, as I mentioned, the recreational space, a culinary school, and other classes, and it is going to be open to the general public. But the question I want to force us to sort of think about in terms of religious freedom is that what if it didn't do any of those things? Would we feel differently about this space? And is the only way in which this becomes acceptable as a project because it does all these things that are quote-unquote interfaith, and do we demand the same things of other communities? So that's one way to think about it. The other is just to put this in the sort of larger question of what's happening in America today. We see that the question of this is not at ground zero and it's not a mosque, but what if it is the kind of question around that we were seeing during the election time. Obama's not a Muslim, but very few people asked, well, what if he is, right? And it kind of is along the same lines of that question. And so it really raises the question of a larger problem we are seeing in America of things Islamic and Muslim. Somehow the fact that people who call themselves terrorists, who call themselves Muslims, and who did what they did on 9/11 in the name of their religion have in some ways become hijacked the tradition and to have taken Islam in their understanding and made it normative. And I would argue that that's not what normative Islam is, and that's certainly not the way in which most Muslims go about living their lives. So the very difficulty with people sort of, and again, getting back to the sensitivity issue, is the inability for people to separate out the fact that a certain population of just terrorists who call themselves Muslims and do this in the name of their religion happen to do what they did on 9/11. And this shouldn't reflect on the 1.3 billion Muslims throughout the world, nor should it affect the ways in which Muslims in America are thought of. So this inability to decouple the events of 9/11 from Islam in general, rather than saying the events of 9/11 were done by these 19 terrorists who should be tried and are and who carried out what they did in the name of Al-Qaeda and not in the name of their religion, is what needs to be coupled. And I think so long as we think of 9/11 as being perpetrated by Muslims and being theologically sound by quoting the Quran, so long as we don't decouple that, it's very difficult for us to get to the sensitivity issues around thinking about Islam and Muslims outside of 9/11. If we think about the ways in which religion comes to the sort of the public and Islam in particular in America, it is through these sort of five what I've been calling the five media pillars of Islam. We often have heard the five pillars of Islam, but today it's almost impossible to talk about Islam without considering at least what I'm calling the five media pillars of Islam. And they are as following. The sort of events of 9/11 as the organizing way in which we come to understand Islam and Muslims. It's very difficult for people, people in this room and people who are studying traditions and are sort of might think very differently, but for the majority of people, the way in which they come to think about Islam and Muslims is post 9/11. You know, even though Islam has a very long history in this country, right from its founding and prior during the slave trade, where scholars like Sylvian Diouf have shown that up to 20% of the slaves who came over in the Atlantic slave trade were Muslims, and we have records of their practices and whatnot. So the very idea of Islam somehow and Muslims just coming to public after 9/11 and always being tied to 9/11 is one of these five media pillars that I'm calling. The second is the theme of violence or terrorism or fundamentalism as, again, the only way in which we come to think about Muslims. We rarely approach Muslims and ask them about their gardens or their architectural practices or art, and we almost think of it as funny in some ways because it's so non-normative, it's so out of the norm in which we approach our traditions, and certainly with Islam. So the second point is violence, terrorism, fundamentalism, and an example of that is jihad, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, madrasa. These are now all English words, I would argue. You know, many of us don't even know what their original words mean, but we know that they mean something in English, right? And so even if we don't know the Arabic or their origins. And then violence and fundamentalism and terrorism, and also in the context of war. You know, so Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Palestine, Guantanamo Bay, Abu Ghraib. These are, again, all the ways in which we come to imagine Islam and Muslims. The third is Muslim women and veiling, and the so-called sort of Islamic patriarchy, as if patriarchy is particular to Islam and not just a problem that we have throughout the world. So the idea of Muslim women somehow and veiling as a particular sign of quote-unquote Muslim backwardness or their tradition or not being modern enough, I think needs to be put into question. A fourth area is this whole notion of Islam and the West. You know, Islam, this religion and way of life, and the West, a geographical area we call the West, maybe Europe and America. So juxtaposing these things always makes it sound like they're at odds. You know, the questions around democracy, is Islam compatible with the West? Are Islamic principles compatible with the West? What about Sharia? So this notion of clash of civilizations, all of these are part of this frame of Islam and the West. And then the last is the sort of the area of the Middle East as our geographic focus for all things Islam and Muslims. You know, the fact that the majority of Muslims in the world live outside of the Middle East, a majority of them who are in South Asia, and the most populous Muslim country, Muslim majority country being Indonesia, our focus still tends to be the Middle East. And it's, and again, we're not going to the Middle East to learn about gardens and the beautiful fountains and the architectural splendors. We often think about the Middle East in terms of politics. And so, again, the ways in which Islam becomes public, I think, is the way it's studied, the debates, the discussions we have are often framed within these five pillars. Now, I've added another couple of pillars, and those are the areas of the debates we often hear or the discussions around Sunnis and Shias. You know, the sort of what's the difference? Why are they at war with each other? Is this historical? Is this theological? Is this political? So that, and then the other one, which is very close to home, is this discussion between African-American Muslims and immigrant Muslims and the kind of discussions around them. One of the ways in which the Park 51 controversy sort of hit me, and again, I mentioned the range of opinions on it, is when it became racialized. And what I mean by that is that there were ways in which many African-Americans and African-American Muslims in particular said that the way in which they were experiencing not just the Park 51 issue, but the larger kind of Islamophobia that's being sort of seen all throughout the U.S. is that a better term for it is not necessarily Islamophobia, but it's anti-Muslim hate or racism. And I began to think about that more seriously and thinking, well, Islamophobia is a term we're using. What does it actually mean? Is it just the ignorance of all things Islamic and Muslim? Is it the fear of Muslims? Is it the fear of the religion of Islam? Is it the fear of Islam as some kind of a political ideology? What is it that people are fearing? When I began to think about this as racialization, I thought, well, many African-American Muslims experience Islamophobia as racism, you know, because they don't necessarily just think of it as religion, but if Islam is, in fact, this way of life, they see the attack on their Muslimness as also an attack on their race, and they don't necessarily always separate this out. So I think it's something to really think about and consider. And it really became apparent to me during the Park 51 controversy when one of the imams, and many others have said this, not just African-American Muslims, have said that what if we were to say that, you know, you can sit on the bus, but you can't just sit here? What if we were to say that to an African-American? It would not only upset us, but we would think this is completely against what it is to be American today. But with Park 51, we're making certain kinds of claims that are saying, well, you can have your community center, but just not here, you know? And it's along those lines that I began to rethink the project and the different ways in which people are experiencing it, or think about the fears that we have when we think about just interchange all things Muslim with things African American, and we say, well, we don't really just want you in this neighborhood. You know, you're okay, and I'm sure you're very nice, but we just don't want you in this neighborhood, white neighborhood. We don't want black people in white neighborhoods. Today, again, we would think that's appalling, but we do it all the time when it comes to Muslims, right? We say, well, it's okay. We just don't want you to have a mosque here, or, you know, you can have your mosque down there, but just why does it have to be in this sort of area? The other thing is to think about is this is not a foreign project coming in. This is a project by Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, who is from the area. This is his neighborhood, and we're actually asking someone to leave their neighborhood because people feel uncomfortable with him. He's already had a congregation 12 blocks away. There's another mosque, as you've probably heard, Masjid Manhattan, 4 blocks away from Ground Zero. So the question of not just proximity, but the fact that these are people who in their own neighborhood are rebuilding because in some ways they want to give back as American Muslims. You know, we forget that this community center and mosque has been a way in which Muslims have tried to think about the various ways in which they can give back to America and give back positively. And yet that often gets lost because they're sort of stuck in the mode of having to justify whether it's why there or where the funding sources are coming from. And just on the note of funding sources, it's very interesting because, you know, whenever you start a project, and again, this whole notion of projection, right? I mean, you have these grand ideas of what you want a center or a place to create and the kind of conversations you want it to have, and you're hoping that you will fundraise. You know, no one knows where that money will come from in advance, but as a brother in the Catholic faith had said to me, you know, when we're handing out the baskets during service, we're never asking, well, where did that person's dollar or $2 come from? Or we don't single out people like that. And so there's an ethical consideration that this is for the greater good. When it comes to this project, it really epitomizes all sorts of anxieties people have, the fears that they have, and some would argue absolutely relevant and acceptable fears, and we should have, you know, as I've argued, we should have discussions around these, but also exceptional fears. Again, the questions that we ask of certain communities and not of others that exceptionalizes Islam and Muslims. So I wanted just two more sort of points before we can open it up to discussion and sort of moderate some of the questions. But is, you know, so the project came into being many years ago. They had envisioned this project. They were hoping these are the sort of what was initially called Cordoba House, but it's the Cordoba Initiative, which is a part of the Park 51 project. So it's the interfaith component of the Park 51 project, which they're calling Cordoba House. There will be maybe two floors given to prayer space, and then the others for the various other projects that they envision, as I mentioned, the recreation and the culinary school, etc. But what is the process by which this became a story, right? And many of us have probably heard of Pamela Geller and Stop the Islamization of America project. And it's really important for us to recognize that this sort of organization and this sort of project of theirs, Stop the Islamization of America, was really behind making this a newsworthy issue. You know, relating all things to the Islamic Cultural Center as, again, evil, part of terrorism, finance, you know, the funding, taking personal attacks at Imam Abdul Rauf, calling it, again, the Ground Zero Mosque, the Mega Mosque, the Victory Mosque. What's interesting is that they never made the same claims for mosques two doors down. And part of the reason is they think of that as okay, because it's not doing the same thing. It's not going to be this grand structure. It's, pardon the expression, but a hole in the wall, really. I mean, it's a really uninhabitable space by any standard, and certainly a really cramped place to pray. But it serves the purpose for now. And so that's been there. And, you know, they haven't received the pushback, partly because they don't have any greater ambition of having an interfaith center or doing all these other things. the Park 51 project becomes an issue because here there's a possibility of Muslims actually having a space of legitimacy, of prominence, of somehow taking back their faith and tradition. So there is, if we look at the Stop the Islamization Project and their website, a lot of what we're seeing in the news and mass media news doesn't actually reflect what's going on online. If we look at what's going on online, I think we'd be shocked. We'd be shocked just as humans. We'd be shocked that this is actually going on in our country. The kind of vitriol, the hate, the threats, the just outrageous threats that are made. So Stop the Islamization was really behind this, and part of their project was to show that the Park 51 project was an effort to delegitimize this project. And let me share with you some of the slides. So this is the site, the Burlington Coat Factory, which is at Park 51 in Lower Manhattan. People say, again, that, you know, it's just this mosque. But if we look at nationwide anti-Muslim activity, it's actually grown. From 2005 to 2010, and this is from the ACLU website. So if you want to follow up, I'm happy to share it with you after the presentation. This is Stop the Islamization of America. This is what you first see on their website, and if many of you probably know that this is a take on or a spoof on the love sign, where it's L-O-V-E usually, and this is and the I is knocked down because it's the Islam, so it's an effort at sort of knocking down Islam. These are photos taken from their Stop the Islamization of America project. That this is a crusade. Terrorism is the disease. Crusades are the cure. Dealing with Muslims, these are the rules of engagement. Rule number one, kill the enemy. Rule number two, there is no rule number two. So, again, these are we're very hard-pressed to see these kinds of images on mass media, but they are the norm if you go to their website and on their Facebook page. And not only are they just the norm there, when we kind of look at the way in which, again, the Park 51 project, anyone who opposes it should not be seen as an Islamophobe, right? I mean, it's very hard not to do that. But it just so happens that many of those who are opposing it are also posting things like this on their website. So it's hard not to make those alignments. Along with posting things like this on the website, they also attack President Obama. So we can see a pattern of, there's images like Obama, Osama, that in fact there are things that have been said, like Sarah Palin retweeting, for example, Ann Coulter's piece saying that in fact Obama is just Taliban in disguise. So these are things that are, these are not just, again, not just things that are going around online and that are there, but these are things done by officials as well. These are people who have come to be seen as experts. These are people who get a huge amount of press and media time as well, including Pamela Geller and Spencer, Robert Spencer, who are behind this Stop the Islamization project, Stop the Islamization of America project. They did two campaigns. One was a bus campaign in New York City, and another was a taxi campaign in Chicago. This was their newest campaign. It was a series of posters that they wanted to put on the New York City buses. It was first, the idea was not accepted, and then they sued, and then I believe it went forward. They had another project prior to this called Leaving Islam. For those who wanted to leave, for those Muslims who wanted to leave Islam safely, quote unquote. So this was their newest project. Why there? Again, this idea of a mega mosque, ground zero, 9/11, conflating all these things. So reinforcing through images these very notions that's then very hard to decouple. These were the taxi cab ads that went through in Chicago. again, honor killing, and I talked about Muslim women and veiling and these sorts of things, but a cultural practice that has often come to be seen as an Islamic practice. So, and this is one of the buses that you can see with the Leaving Islam ad that was done last year. This was one of the posters that was done for the rally. It's, do you want a mosque at Ground Zero? Stop the Islamization of America doesn't. Help SIOA stop the mosque, protest, organize, contact right, and never forget. So again, the linking of these two things together. These are some of the images from the protests. The protests are very interesting sites for thinking about what it is that people think about when they think about the proposed project. You know, so this idea that that Sharia is taking over, I mean, kind of an absurd claim to make in the U.S. I mean, it really, if people actually think that, then they don't have very much faith in the power of our Constitution, which is a little strange for me, because these are all folks who see themselves as hyper-American and upholding the Constitution. I'm just going to show a couple more slides, and I'll make some closing remarks. This is another one of the rallies. A mosque at Ground Zero spits on the graves of 9/11 victims. Islam is of the devil, and these were T-shirts that were used during the Quran burning in Gainesville in Florida, and then were also used at many of the other rallies. And Reza Aslan, I just want to sort of end with this. He says, that is exactly the playbook of anti-Muslim groups. Link fear of the recession to fear of Islam. Link fear of terrorism to fear of Islam. More security equals less Islam. So I just want to, I haven't even hit on some of the other two points that I wanted to make. One was around the ways in which the U.S. Has been involved in the last few years through the RAND report, and you could read this in the RAND report, of creating moderate Muslims. And I have a real problem with this term, but maybe we can discuss it at the Q&A. But it's a strategy paper on how to create moderate Muslims, and one of the concerns I have is that the recommendation that was made in 2003 by the RAND report and the one that's being made now get worse and worse, and the one that was made most recently in 2007, RAND Corporation, as many of you know, is the likes of Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and others, probably enough said, who are trying to create, amongst other things, moderate Muslim networks. So one of the biggest proposals that they had put out was that Islam has to look in some ways much more like other religions, that they, Muslims need to be less tied to their tradition. And by less tied to their tradition, that means that they shouldn't really believe that the Quran is the word of God, and that Muhammad, our prophet, our last prophet, peace be upon him, is central to the ways in which Muslims come to think about their faith and embody it and practice it. So what's very central to the Islamic tradition is actually seen as the problem. So the RAND report says, you know, Muslims should just not take this stuff so seriously and should only have a symbolic relationship to their tradition, you know, which, again, goes completely against the Islamic tradition. But I want to end with just a note about what this pushes us to think about in terms of sort of the ethics of all of this. And what I mean by ethics is, how do we understand or come to think about as Muslims not just having a right to something like the Park 51 project, but just ways in which we are working towards some kind of understanding and respect and mutuality, even if we differ. Park 51 project, whether it happens or not, the ways in which we can imagine ourselves in conversations, and there's so many different people, and probably everyone in this room is involved with some project or another on bringing the common good forward. But it's the line that I like to use about, you know, if you're approaching something with beauty, it's most likely that you'll try to seek beauty out of that. But if you approach something with ugliness, it's also likely that you'll find from that ugliness. So I want to encourage us to think about approaching things with beauty, and to also think about sort of the ethics of all of this in terms of who the other is. I just want to end with a quote, if I can find it. here. And then we can open it up to the Q&A. It's a more sort of philosophical, I guess, question about who the other is. And this is from Judith Butler, a great sort of scholar of our time, also teaches at UC Berkeley, and she's written this in her book called Precarious Life. She says, when we recognize another or when we ask for recognition for ourselves, we are not asking for another to see us as we are, as we already are, as we have always been, as we were constituted prior to the encounter itself. Instead, in the asking, in the petition, we have already become something new, something we are constituted by virtue of the address, a need, a desire for the other that takes place in the language in the broadest sense, one without which we could not be. To ask for recognition or to offer it is precisely not to ask for recognition for what one already is. It is to solicit a becoming, to instigate a transformation, to petition the future always in relationship to the other. It is also to stake one's own being and one's own persistence in one's own being in the struggle for recognition. And so I just end with that quote and thank you all for your patience.
Thank you very much, Dr. Munir. And I just wanted to correct a couple of things. The Quran burning didn't actually take place, but that was probably
the proposed Quran burning.
The other thing is that I think I'm very appreciated by my neighbors for my garden, even though I am engaged in a jihad with my local deer. Uh-huh. But so far I'm winning. They've been outnumbered right now by my new flowers. Uh-huh. All right. Thank you very much for that enlightening talk. And I will now be moderating today's question and answer period. We'd also like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California and that you are listening to Park 51, the New York Islamic Center Project. So I have a number of questions specifically about the project, and then I have others that are not totally related. In the interest of focusing on the topic at hand, I will begin with those, and then if we have time remaining, I will go to the not as related. I believe you had mentioned initially the title for the project was the Cordoba Project, and then they later changed it to Park 51. Can you just, again, elaborate, was that name a reflection of Cordoba, Spain, and why do you think they chose that particular name?
Well, in the interpretation of Imam Abdul Rauf, it was really to hearken back to a time where Jews, Christians, and Muslims live together. And it might be a sort of nostalgia for times past where, in fact, people did live in harmony together and appreciated each other's intellectual traditions, prayers, architectural practices, and others. So I think he was drawing on that interpretation or that remembering Cordoba in that way. Others want to remember it as a time where Muslims were triumphant, and therefore linking that to Park 51 was, again, the ways in which people tried to couple the triumphalism, so-called, of this project with the triumphalism of Cordoba past. And so but Imam Faisal, of course, didn't interpret it in that way. He was thinking about it as a way in which Jews, Christians, and Muslims actually lived harmoniously together for many centuries.
All right, thank you. You touched on this briefly, but who will be providing the money to fund Park 51? Are the donors going to be foreign or U.S. citizens?
Yeah, I think, we don't know. I mean, there'll be a whole host of them, but what we do know is a project this transparent, the funding will not go unnoticed. that is for sure. And so I think just the very publicness of this project will make it. But, I want to maybe ask a larger question, that the idea that all things foreign are somehow un-American or suspect is also needs to be put into question. I mean, we had a lot of foreign funding during these midterm elections. maybe that's what makes foreign funding so suspect. It's a bad reputation it gets from these kind of midterm elections. But I do think that there are ways in which we need to really nuance the fact that just because something is foreign, and that's the whole idea of just working against this whole notion that, you know, somehow Americans are the good Muslims and Muslims in the other parts of the world are bad Muslims, and to create, again, this good, bad Muslim, and also America as good and somehow all things foreign as bad. So I want to sort of caution against the idea that things foreign are already deemed suspect.
And I think a lot of people, including Jon Stewart, focused on the fact that Fox News, one of its major investors, is the Saudi prince, Walid ibn Talal.
Right.
And
somehow Fox doesn't protest that. I mean, the Islamic, so-called Islamic funding of Fox is also very interesting.
It's okay when we do it.
Right.
Right.
And also, just to add, you know, the same idea of foreignness as somehow derogatory, we see that being used against Obama, right? The fact that we should be celebrating a president who had an upbringing in Indonesia and has lived in Hawaii and has been, as a Kenyan father. And, you know, we should be celebrating that diversity. In fact, those are the very things that are used against him as being not being American enough. So we really need to think about the kind of parochialism of what it is. I mean, I thought America was supposed to be about the world, not about kind of confining ourselves to a very narrow understanding of what it is to be American.
Well, I love this question, but I'm not sure if you're going to have the answer to this. I heard that the architect is to build a green building, if he's from California.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea?
That is part of it. If you go to their, if we go to their website, right at the, I'll just bring up their website. It does, I think it does make that, they are trying to make this as green as possible building. So they're thinking about a lot of things. So they're, you know, not only in terms of architectural materials and whatnot, but just the use of the space. So it is part of their vision.
LEEDS. Great. Do you think the Park 51 project was used politically by the conservatives to drum up the agenda to win the election? This topic has become quiet these days.
The worry that I have is those ideas don't go away. So if we look online, it's full of it. You know, it's still there. Just the mass media haven't taken it up as much. But sure, from Gingrich to Palin to all the kind of conservative pundits, we have seen how the Park 51 project has been mobilized. So, you know, as many would say, it's the one place, it's the one thing you're assured. If you're the more Islamophobic you can be, for conservatives or Republicans, it's likely to gain you votes. So the more sort of anti-Muslim you can be, and of course we have varying data to kind of show this, but, you know, when Republicans overwhelmingly said they would rather have a strip club than the Islamic Community Center in that area, it kind of tells you, gives you a sense of what we're dealing with. And certainly most of us know how Islam and Muslims were used to mobilize, or the Park 51 project was used to delegitimize Muslims and to gain votes for
not only in New York, but even in Las Vegas, Minneapolis, where we had the first Muslim congressman. His opponents were obviously making hay by the fact that he was Muslim.
Right.
And he was able to win his third term.
Right.
Keith Ellison.
That's right.
So you touched on this a little bit when you were describing what is going on within the center. It's going to include, I haven't heard of the culinary school. That sounds fascinating. I heard of the swimming pool.
Right, a basketball court.
Basketball court, okay. So this asks specifically about including a synagogue for Jewish worship to be part of the building, as maybe on a separate floor, and they actually asked to exclude it appears anti-Semitic, which kind of goes back to your question. Would people be asking this about a synagogue that they include, you know, an interfaith space or possibly a prayer space for other faiths?
Right. I think part of the anxiety is that no one had an issue with this until it became newsworthy. But again, when it did become newsworthy, then people were thinking, well, why is it that the Ground Zero has not been memorialized through some kind of physical space? And we know it will be next year on the 10th anniversary. But part of the anxiety was that, you know, again, the Stop the Islamization folks said, how dare an Islamic community center go up before Ground Zero has been memorialized sufficiently? So we haven't actually filled the space. and people haven't been able to mourn and go through rituals. But the very fact that just Muslims wanted to build a mosque, I think, as I mentioned, it's already gone from the idea of a mosque and a prayer space to including people of different traditions. I think that's already been a huge effort on the part of Muslims. Whether it makes it legitimate or not to have other prayer spaces where everyone will be welcome to pray is, you know, is that's never taken up. You know, the fact that people can go in and pray if they want. We're not asking the YMCA or JCC to include mosque spaces because they know if Muslims come in and they need to pray, I'm sure they'll be welcome to pray. So they're not intentionally building a separate space and just saying, well, you're welcome to use the space that's there already. So again, I think that we should be careful about saying that the only way that it's legitimate is if it does these X, Y, and Z things. You know, it should a community. If we're talking about religious freedom, then we should be talking about the ways in which a community decides amongst itself and amongst its adherents and those who are for it, for that space, to decide what it should look like, and they should be part of the conversations and welcome various other ideas. So, as you know, that Daisy Khan's been on in the media a lot, and she's said over and over the model has been the YMCA and the JCC, and that's a great thing.
Mm-hmm. So. And you've had a lot of Jewish leaders coming out and supporting the project. Do you think this is possibly because they've actually experienced some of the same sentiments around, you know, their synagogues and their ability to worship freely in this country as well?
Yeah, I think we can't applaud that enough. You know, I think that even though I show this kind of stop the Islamization images, by and large, you know, there is this debate going on in America about who we are. And as I keep saying, this is, I don't want to just, I really want to Americanize this project and what's going on rather than Islamizing it, right? I want this to be a larger conversation about what it is to be American. And I think we've seen the best of that. You know, so many interfaith groups, Michael Pappas is right here, Iftikhar Hay and other brothers, Shafi Rifai, and so many people, I'm sure everyone in this room has worked towards some kind of common good. And I think that's in some ways really what America is. You know, that through all the kind of hardships that people go through, goodness always triumphs in the end. And we've seen that in the Park 51 project. We saw as much hatred as there was a great generosity pouring out of people, interfaith groups, civic engagement of, that was just left, right, and center. And so we really need to acknowledge that and applaud it and really push ourselves to making sure that that gets heard. That's the voice that's out there and not just the voice of hatred and misunderstanding, disrespect.
Absolutely. So. We had one, I think it was on September 11th, the day after Read the Quran Day, organized by a local Jewish organization. I don't know if you were there, mm-hmm. where people sat and read different verses. And then, of course, Mayor Bloomberg, John Stewart, Keith Olbermann, who unfortunately has now kind of moved on. So absolutely, I mean, it's brought a lot of the good voices out. One of the common claims by those, not only against the mosque, but against, you know, Islamic centers in general, is that in many Muslim countries, such as Iraq, or they usually talk about Saudi Arabia, you know, those groups are not allowed to build their churches or mm-hmm. their synagogues. So, you know, number one, you know, why should we allow Muslims to be able to build their mosques mm-hmm. here if over there they're not allowed to build their centers of worship? And also what can be done to stop that kind of persecution? And I just received an email from Hamza. There was a march today, actually, to protest mm-hmm. the killings of mm-hmm. Christians in Iraq. So mm-hmm. there are small movements. And I was at a fundraiser yesterday where one of the imams called for a million-man march against terrorism. So mm-hmm. a lot of Muslims are asking mm-hmm. the same question. Right. But just on the issue of, right. you know, if they won't let us do it there, or is it right. even true that they won't leave us there? Because I lived in Jordan, and literally on every street there's a mosque, and next to it is a church. Mm-hmm. So there are mm-hmm. specific countries like Saudi Arabia where they do not allow it, but in many other countries they do. Right. But what is your thought on
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I think we need to differentiate countries, you know, and not make equivalents. I mean, we're in a democracy. I mean, if we're going to compare ourselves to Saudi Arabia, it seems a little strange. I mean, they're not making the same democratic claims that we are. So I think we need to really put this in context. And there are different ways in which people live out democracy. You know, we're not, you know, even though we say we're a democratic country, there are many things that don't feel or we experience as democratic. You know, racism doesn't feel very democratic. Anti-Semitism doesn't feel very democratic. Not being able to build spaces or, you know, I mean, buying election votes. And, I mean, you know, these things don't somehow feel as democratic as we claim. So the idea is that, you know, what constitutes a democracy and working towards the best of that and recognizing the diversity of it. So to make these kind of equivalents, I think, is just wrong. And then the other is to ask Muslims who are in this country to somehow account for other countries. I mean, asking Americans in general to account for, you know, saying to Christians, well, you haven't sufficiently accounted for, I don't know, the poverty in Colombia. I mean, it's that kind of strange relationship that we're associating Muslims who are in America to account for things that they may not be familiar with themselves or who are not from those countries to somehow know about the insides of their politics. And the other thing is just that, the politics rather than, you know, again, the sociopolitical contexts are more important to understand than the theology. I mean, if we look at theologically what is happening, then we can actually say that not forbidding people to build synagogues and churches is in fact un-Islamic, because throughout the Quran, of course, Jews and Muslims are recognized as people of the book. There are verses that actually say that you have to protect religious sites. So, you know, what do we do with all those things that then seem a little bit sort of off when you're seeing that certain countries won't permit that? And maybe going back to Islamic principles would in fact bring them back to being more democratic. And that's what we're often seeing in much of the Muslim world. Many of those who are advocating democracy are also advocating Sharia principles. And by Sharia principles, I mean things like the things we never hear in public and in the media, but Sharia are based on at least 4, 5, 6 major principles, which are called the Maqasid Sharia, which are things around the right of life, the right of family, the right to education, the right to religion, the right to dignity, and the right to property. I mean, this is what any laws or fiqh and Islamic jurisprudence have to be based on. We don't see that in much of the Muslim world, so we need to push for, in fact, we do need to push for Sharia, because it, in some ways it brings back those principles which seem in some ways so marginalized. And in fact, many would argue that is what keeps the despots in check. It's the Sharia principles that will actually keep people in check. It's not all the other things we hear about, which is, you know, chopping off of hands or honor killings and these sorts of things, which have sort of given Sharia a bad name, and many of which are un-Islamic by their very nature, their cultural practices rather than religious ones.
And that's a whole talk unto itself. It's very difficult to address that in a couple of minutes. We hear again all the time, you know, why, if Islam is a religion of peace, where are the moderate Muslims? Why are they not speaking out against terrorism? And you know, since 9/11, I think a lot of organizations have heard that. And, you know, as part of an organization, I know that we have done our best with press releases, with the talks that we give. But unfortunately, the media does tend to focus on the extreme voices in both camps. But why do you think, is it in fact that Muslims are not doing enough? Is there more they can do?
I think, yeah, we always have to push for doing more as much as we can. But, you know, again, the idea that Muslims haven't spoken out, I mean, many of us have lost our voices sort of saying this. And the idea, again, of who, you know, these markers of moderate and traditional and fundamentalist, and I mean, they don't sit very well, partly because is a moderate Muslim just a Muslim who agrees with all things American? But what if, as an American, you don't agree with the way the elections happen, or you don't agree with the way in which the environment is going? Does that make you un-American, and therefore, you know, does it, you know? So again, I think the question around what constitutes a good Muslim comes out of these kinds of questions, and it's very hard. I think there's so many groups that have come out against terrorism. There have been fatwas. There have been all sort of the Common Word group. The 138 scholars, the fatwas upon fatwas.
600-page document by a scholar from Pakistan.
Right.
The American Muslim actually is a website that has documented a lot of the different fatwas. So, yeah.
Right. And in some ways, it's for mass media to also take it up and to show that, in fact, you know, I mean, it's very hard to keep saying that and ask you know, we need to ask people, well, where have you been and where are you looking that you haven't heard Muslims sort of condemn terrorism? And we need to condemn terrorism along the same lines as we condemn the violence that we perpetrate on others. You know, somehow the way which we've decoupled, again, the morality of the violence that we perpetrate on others as Americans and that others perpetrate on us, they register at different levels. We always do it in the name of democracy and freedom, but we're killing. Mm-hmm. You know, families are lost, children are dying, and so they don't experience it as that. But things that are done to us as Americans somehow seem beyond the pale and unacceptable. So I think we also need to really put this in a more human perspective of, if we're going to talk about loss of life and we're going to talk about war and terrorism and violence, then we need to do it across the board and around the world, not just somehow claiming that as Americans our lives are more important than the lives of others, wherever they might be.
All right. Well, that brings us to 5 minutes after the hour, and I think that will have to be our last question. I really want to thank you, Dr. Munirjiwa, for this enlightening talk. And I'd also like to thank the audience here as well as those listening. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.